Nicotra podcast conversations for the curious, essential knowledge simplified. Your gateway to essential ideas that matter most.
Have you ever felt utterly stuck? You know, like your path was just set in stone. Or maybe you felt like you were just playing a role someone else wrote for you. What if even right in those moments, those feelings of constraint, you were actually still fundamentally, like undeniably free?
It's a powerful thought, isn't it?
It really is. Welcome, everyone, to The Deep Dive. Today, we are plunging headfirst into a really foundational, maybe even mind-bending work of 20th century philosophy.
Jean-Paul Sartre's Being and Nothingness.
Exactly. And this deep dive is tailor-made for you, our listeners. We're using your shared sources to navigate its complex, but honestly, incredibly insightful landscape.
And our mission, well, it's what we always aim for, extracting those really potent nuggets of insight. We want to give you a kind of shortcut to understanding one of the most profound inquiries out there.
Into what it means to be human. Right, what it means to be human, to be conscious, and crucially, to be truly free. We're hoping to unlock why these radical ideas still resonate so deeply today.
Yeah, for your personal agency, right? Your relationships, how you understand responsibility.
All of that. It touches everything.
Okay, so let's unpack this a bit. Jean-Paul Sartre, he lived from 1905 to 1980. And he wasn't just some dusty academic.
Not at all.
He was the leading figure, really, of French existentialism, a philosopher who, you know, truly lived his philosophy. Mm-hmm. He was educated at the super prestigious École Normale Supérieure in Paris. He's soaked up German phenomenology that's basically studying the structure of our lived experience, how things appear to us.
From thinkers like Husserl and Heidegger, yeah. Big names.
Big names. Mm-hmm. But then he just completely forged his own unique path, didn't he?
He absolutely did. And what makes Sartre so uniquely positioned to write something like Being and Nothingness? I mean, his background wasn't just in that rigorous philosophical analysis, though he definitely had the chops for that.
Yeah.
He was also a celebrated novelist, think Nausea, and a playwright, too. But then you add his experiences.
During the war.
Exactly. As a member of the French Resistance during World War II, he was captured, became a prisoner of war. And that profoundly shaped his understanding of freedom, of choice, under the most extreme life or death circumstances imaginable.
Wow.
So you get this blend of intense intellectual rigor and just stark lived experience.
Yeah.
It gives his philosophy this urgency.
Yeah, a grounded reality that maybe purely theoretical stuff can lack.
Precisely. It was philosophy forged in the crucible of real-world struggle, you could say.
And he needed that urgency, didn't he? Because Being and Nothingness, published in 1943, I mean, think about that timing. During the Nazi occupation of Paris?
Dark times.
It feels almost like an act of philosophical resistance in itself. It's this huge, sprawling attempt to figure out what it truly means to be human, conscious, how we relate to each other, all under that immense pressure.
Absolutely. And what it does, fundamentally, is challenge traditional essentialist thinking.
Okay, what's essentialism again, basically?
It's that deep-seated idea that things, including us humans, have a fixed, predetermined nature, an essence. Like, we come with a built-in purpose or definition.
Like we have pre-installed software.
Exactly. And Sartre just throws that out. He says, no, we're more like an empty device, constantly creating our own software. He proposes this radical rethinking, where human consciousness is defined by its fundamental freedom.
Freedom to choose, freedom to create meaning.
Right. He's basically tearing down centuries of philosophical assumptions and saying, nope, it's not like that at all.
And the absolute core of this, the phrase everyone quotes, is his famous declaration, existence precedes essence. That sounds simple, maybe, but it flips our whole understanding of human nature on its head, doesn't it?
Completely flips it. It means the exact opposite of what we usually assume. You know, most things like this pen. It was designed with a purpose, its essence, before it was made.
Right. Someone knew what it was for.
But for us humans, Sartre says, there's no pre-written script, no divine blueprint, no fixed human nature. A human being first exists, just appears on the scene, bam, and only then defines their identity, their purpose, their values, through their choices and actions. You are not born with a destiny. You are, as you mentioned, like an ongoing project. You're constantly creating yourself.
So my job title, my family background, even my past mistakes, they don't define my essence.
According to Sartre, no. They're part of your history, what he calls your facticity, the facts about you.
Yeah.
But you are still the active creator of who you are right now, in this very moment, and in every moment to come.
Which leads to maybe the most challenging part, and frankly, kind of mind-bending when you first encounter it. Sartre argues consciousness is essentially Nothingness.
Ah, yes.
Nothingness.
When I first read that, I thought, okay, is this just clever philosophical wordplay, or does it actually mean something for how we feel being alive? Oh, it's absolutely not just wordplay. And it's critical for understanding Creedum. But before you picture some empty void, think of this nothingness differently. Yeah. Think of it as a powerful whole in being. It's our radical capacity to question everything, to doubt, to negate what is.
To say no.
Exactly. It's why we can look at the world as it is and imagine it differently. Imagine alternatives. Make choices that aren't just reactions. This isn't just absence. Sartre sees it as the ultimate source of human creativity and freedom.
So it's the space where choice happens.
Precisely. It's the ability to step back, to envision what does not yet exist. So this nothingness isn't just emptied space. It's the very engine of human potential. It's why we're not just puppets reacting to the world.
We shape it. We dream up futures.
We ask, what if? That's the nothingness at work.
Wow. Okay, so this lack of a preset nature, this nothingness at our core, that's why Sartre says we are condemned to be free. That word condemned, though, it sounds less like a gift and more like a burden.
It is a burden, in a way. Condemned implies it's inescapable. It's not a freedom we can choose to accept or reject. We're just thrown into it.
Born into it.
Born into it, constantly making choices. And because of that, we must take full, absolute responsibility for everything we choose, everything we do.
No excuses. No blaming fate or God or society.
No external authority gets you off the hook. No divine purpose, no preset essence, no excuses. You are the ultimate authority for your own life. And yeah, as you said, that's not just empowering. It can feel terrifying.
Which brings up a question for you listening. How does that idea actually make you feel about your day-to-day choices? Is that liberating, or does it just feel like way too much pressure?
Because that pressure, that profound anxiety, Sartre calls it anguish, mm-hmm. that comes with realizing this radical freedom, it's so intense.
So intense that we try to run away from it.
Exactly. We often try to escape it. And this escape isn't always some big dramatic gesture. Often it's a really subtle, almost sneaky form of self-deception.
Which Sartre calls bad faith.
That's the one, bad faith. It's this fascinating, almost tragic lie we tell ourselves. It happens within the unity of a single consciousness, meaning on some level we know we're free, but we actively pretend we're not.
We convince ourselves we're objects, not subjects.
Sort of, yeah. Mm. We try to deny our freedom. And Sartre gives these incredibly vivid, relatable examples.
Like the waiter. That one always sticks with me.
The waiter in the cafe, right?
Mm-hmm.
His movements are just a little too precise, aren't they? A bit too theatrical. It's like he's playing at being a waiter.
Overdoing it.
He's trying to reduce his free, conscious self down to the determined role of waiter, as if that's his fixed essence, his entire being. He's denying his freedom to be anything else, or even just to interpret the role differently. He's trying to convince himself, I am just a waiter, that's all.
In the woman on a first date example?
Yes. She knows her companion has romantic intentions. He takes her hand, and she just leaves it there. Passively.
Neither accepting nor rejecting.
Exactly. She treats her hand like a mere physical object, detached from her will. She pretends it's not her hand connected to her conscious choice to avoid the decision of accepting or rejecting his advance. She's deceiving herself about her own role and responsibility in that moment.
It's chilling how recognizable that feels.
And what's fascinating, or maybe disturbing, is how often we all probably do similar things in big or small ways.
Yeah. So for you listening, think about times you've said, oh, I have no choice, or, well, that's just my personality. I can't help it. Are you maybe acting in bad faith? Are you avoiding the anxiety of making a tough choice?
What choices are you perhaps denying in your own life right now?
It's a really uncomfortable mirror Sartre holds up, but potentially incredibly powerful if you engage with it.
Those questions about our own bad faith hit close to home. But, you know, as much as we wrestle with our individual freedom, we're rarely ever truly alone, are we?
No, definitely not.
So how does the presence of other people change this whole picture for Sartre?
Right, that's the crucial next layer, because we absolutely do not exist in a vacuum. Sartre dives deep into how our very sense of self, our existence, gets profoundly transformed by the other.
Other people.
Other people. And specifically by their presence, and even more critically, by their gaze. The central concept here is the look, le regard in French.
The look.
Yeah. Imagine you're completely absorbed in something, totally focused, being a subject, the center of your own world. You're just doing your thing.
Mm-hmm. Lost in the moment.
Exactly. But then suddenly you realize someone is watching you. You feel eyes on you. In that instant, Sartre says, your world is stolen.
Stolen. How so?
You're no longer just a pure subject experiencing things from the inside. You suddenly become an object for the other's consciousness. Your subjective world gets kind of turned inside out, seen from the outside.
And Sartre's famous example for this is the man peeping through a keyhole, right?
Exactly. He's totally immersed, a pure subject in his voyeuristic act, until he hears a footstep behind him. He realizes he's been caught, he's being watched.
And what happens then?
He's flooded with shame. He instantly sees himself as the other sees him, as this jealous, vulgar voyeur. His identity in that moment is defined from the outside. He's objectified by that gaze.
That's a powerful illustration of how the other's presence can fundamentally alter our self-perception.
And this constant interaction of freedoms, this clashing of gazes, often leads to conflict, doesn't it? Which brings us to that really famous line.
From his play, No Exit.
Hell is other people. Which sounds incredibly bleak, but it doesn't mean other people are inherently evil, right? It's more subtle than that.
Exactly. It's not about people being bad. It's about the inescapable nature of being objectified. The constant judgment, the way others' perspectives define us, prevents us from ever feeling purely and freely ourselves. We're always being turned into an object in someone else's world.
So our desire to define ourselves bumps up against their desire to define us.
Constantly. Relationships, for Sartre, often become this sort of struggle, maybe unconscious, but still there to possess or be possessed, to define or be defined. It's a challenging, maybe even pessimistic view, but it offers a deep insight into social friction.
Okay, so we're radically free, but we're constantly bumping into other freedoms, and we're also dealing with the concrete facts of our lives.
Right. Sartre fully acknowledges that while we are radically free, we are always freedom in a situation. We're not just free-floating spirits. We have what he calls facticity.
Facticity. Those are the brute, unchangeable facts of our existence.
Exactly. Your body, your past, the environment you were born into, your history. You can't choose these things. They are the givens.
You used a great analogy for this once, like cards you're dealt.
Yeah, think of facticity as the hand of cards you're dealt in life. Your height, where you were born, maybe certain innate talents or limitations, the family you grew up in. You didn't choose those cards. They are simply there.
Okay, so those are the facts. But then there's transcendence.
Right. Transcendence is how you play those cards. A seemingly bad hand doesn't automatically mean you lose the game.
So you transcend the facts by giving them meaning?
Precisely. You choose their meaning and how you'll move forward from them. That mountain over there, it's just a lump of rock, facticity. But it only becomes an obstacle if your project is to climb it, or a beautiful view if your project is to admire it.
The meaning comes from my intention, my project.
Exactly. And this leads to Sartre's idea of your fundamental project. This is like the original free choice of being that orients your entire life. It gives meaning and coherence to all your smaller actions and choices.
So it's like the underlying choice of who I'm trying to be in the world.
Yes, it's how you unify your life. Not through some hidden subconscious drive, like Freud might say, but through a conscious or at least pre-reflective choice about the kind of existence you're aiming for. It's the overarching theme you choose, even if you never sit down and write it out explicitly.
Okay, that's a lot to take in. If we try to boil this down, connect all these dots, what are the really critical takeaways from this deep dive into Sartre for you listening?
Well, first and foremost, definitely existence precedes essence. Remember that one. You are the author of your own identity, your own values, no script, no destiny. You're creating it as you go.
You're always in the process of becoming. And tied to that is radical freedom and absolute responsibility. You are completely free, and because of that, you are fully responsible for everything you choose and do.
No blaming allowed, no excuses. It's the weight, but also maybe the glory of being human. It demands authenticity.
Then there's bad faith. We have to be vigilant against that self-deception.
Right.
The ways we pretend we're not free to avoid the anxiety. Ask yourself, am I really trapped here, or am I just avoiding a difficult choice?
That honesty is key. And then the other. And conflict. Remember that your existence is shaped by other people, by their gaze. This naturally leads to some level of conflict as freedoms collide. Understanding this might help manage expectations and relationships.
Yeah, realizing that friction isn't always someone's fault, but maybe part of the human condition.
It could lead to more realistic interactions. And finally, meaning is created. Purpose isn't something you find lying around. You create it.
Through your choices, your commitments, your fundamental project.
It's an active construction, not a passive discovery. So if you feel lost, Sartre says the answer lies in choosing, in creating, in committing.
And these aren't just abstract philosophical points, are they? They have real-world applications.
Absolutely. They offer powerful tools for your life. Think about personal empowerment. Truly internalizing this idea of radical freedom helps you stop making excuses.
You take ownership.
You take ownership of your choices. You realize you can change. That thought, oh, I'm just not a creative person, becomes, okay, I am currently choosing not to engage in creative projects, or I can't leave this awful job, becomes, I am choosing to stay in this job right now for reasons X, Y, and Z.
It puts the power and the responsibility squarely back on you.
Exactly. And what about understanding social anxiety? The concept of the look can be strangely comforting.
How so?
It helps you understand that feeling self-conscious, worrying about how others see you, it's a universal human experience rooted in this fear of being objectified. It's not just your personal failing. Knowing that might help manage those feelings.
That makes sense. It contextualizes it. And navigating relationships.
Sartre's ideas about conflict, about the struggle between freedoms, can lead to more realistic expectations. Maybe more respectful approaches, too. Recognizing the other person is also a free subject, a being for itself, not just an object in your world.
Asserting your freedom while respecting theirs.
It's a delicate balance. And crucially, creating purpose. For anyone feeling adrift, Sartre's philosophy is a call to action.
Don't wait to find your purpose.
Create it. Build your meaning through your commitments, your actions, your projects, piece by piece.
So wrapping up this dive into Sartre, what really stands out to you personally from all this? For me, I think it's still that sheer weight of responsibility that comes with the freedom. It's both a kind of terrifying and incredibly empowering at the same time. It's a constant call to be authentic.
Yeah, I agree. And raises that final profound question Sartre grapples with. He suggests that our fundamental human desire to be both completely free like consciousness for itself and completely solid and grounded like an object in itself, essentially to be a self-caused God, is an impossible contradiction.
A contradiction. So we're doomed to fail in our deepest desire.
He calls man a useless passion because that ultimate synthesis is impossible. Yet, crucially, he suggests this doesn't mean life is meaningless or that ethics are impossible. The striving might be for an impossible goal, but perhaps the striving itself is what matters.
So here's a final thought for you to chew on. If our deepest desire to be this in itself for itself is ultimately a useless passion, a project doomed to fail, does that make our choices meaningless?
Or does it make the very act of choosing, moment by moment, the most profound, authentic, and maybe courageous act of meaning-making we can possibly undertake?
What does recognizing this potentially useless passion at the heart of being human change about how you approach your own grand passions, your own projects? What meaning will you choose to create from that understanding? See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.